So we're starting here looking at the second precept. It says, only God is God. And I entitled that for a reason that I hope will be clear as we go through this. Remember, last lesson, we discussed the principle that God exists. Now, the Bible never proves that God exists. It accepts it for a fact that God does exist. There is no proof that you can present to logically prove the existence of God. Because God is outside of our five senses. Spiritual realm, the metaphysical, is outside what we can prove from our own perspective. It's almost like the problem centuries ago between Galileo and the Pope, which is not taught properly. Galileo was copying from other men of his day, saying that the earth and the planets revolve around the sun rather than everything revolve around the earth. And the Pope said, if you make that statement a fact, you must be able to prove that fact. See, no one else had made that a statement of fact, because when you're standing on the earth, what can you prove? Nothing. You could not prove that the planets and all that revolve around the earth. It appears that they do. But you cannot prove it, nor can you prove that everything revolves around the sun, because you are limited from your perspective where you're at. And Galileo went ahead and published that as a statement of fact. And that's why the church and him had a problem, because he was publishing as fact that which was philosophy. In other words, he couldn't prove it as fact, and he was then making accusations against the Catholic position without any basis of fact. If he had stated it as another position, like everyone else had, there would not have been a problem. And he really wasn't punished all that much anyway, because him and the Pope were good friends. This just happened to be a philosophical, ecclesiastical dispute. The church was not trying to suppress knowledge. In fact, the church was trying to promote knowledge. If you can prove it as a fact, you can make that statement. The Bible doesn't prove it as a fact. The Bible accepts it as a fact. Same thing. So from our perspective, we cannot prove or disprove the existence of God. Therefore, in fact, we can't do that about Satan or angels or anything. So we have to rely upon other evidence. And that is what these precepts are designed to teach people, even us today. These are statements designed to get you to think, to get you to explore what it means. Like in this one, you'll have no gods beyond the Lord God. What does that mean? And so you start meditating on it, and you start following the little threads and the ramifications, and you build upon it, and pretty soon you'll see that that statement has tentacles that extend everywhere. And we're going to see that today. So when you talk about the Ten Commandments, you get the idea that these are precepts that I have to do or God hates me or God will punish me. But that's not what they are at all, because you cannot keep these ever. So God did not put these up here and demand that you do this or I'm going to punish you, and I know you can't do it, therefore I get to punish you. No wonder everyone's upset with God. They made up a false God. They made up a false argument that forces you into a conclusion that's not true to get you to say that God is either not real, not true, or God is hateful. Well, they have their own agenda for doing that, and you need to not get involved in those kinds of arguments because they're designed to force you into a position that that's not true. Now, I changed this graphic here a bit to make it more reflective of what the ten, of the division of the ten precepts. So we see that Yahweh is God. I am is God. That's what we talked about last week in the first precept. This one we're going to talk about today is no gods or idols. Next week, we'll talk about holy is God's name, and then after that, the Sabbath is holy. The Sabbath is really a bridge between the two, between that which is God's domain and that which is man's domain. And of course, not only is it a bridge, but Christ himself is the bridge that allows us to then understand these and keep these. In fact, when we come over here to the man's side of the pyramid, we're going to be spending some time in the Gospels as Christ interprets these for us and teaches us how to understand them. So ancient men relied on the man God. Nimrod, he was a prototype of a man God intercessor. Him and his queen set themselves up as gods and goddesses, and it must have been an interesting court. And it must have had a lot of palace intrigues, because when we come to looking at the various mythologies that occurred after Babel, we see the gods and goddesses are just running amok. They're fighting, they're arguing. If you're an Etruscan, your pantheon is at least sitting down and talking. If you're Greek, they're arguing and fighting and sleeping around with everybody. Gods, goddesses, and people, and it's just a mess. So that must have been an interesting court there before God came down and ended that, because he spread them out. And of course, that ideal, that view they had of that unity, they carried with them, and then they modified it according to their cultures as they were building their cultures up. So each culture ruler filled this man-god role, and that's what Pharaoh was. Pharaoh was both priest, that's the title Pharaoh, he was priest of Egypt, and then he was king of Egypt, so he was the god-man, or the man God, as the intercessor between society and what they believe their gods were, and helping to fulfill what they believe they need to do to maintain Maat, to maintain balance. However, the nine signs and the Passover demonstrated the fallacy of the man God rulers. And the next set of kingdoms that sprang up during what has come to be called the Axial Age, the king no longer is both man and God. He's no longer priest and king. Yes, he's king, he's powerful, he's a warrior, usually. But they have their own priesthood over here on the side now. I wonder where they got that from. Well, that would be from the Hebrews. Because the Hebrews, they had their own priestly caste. And because they had their own priestly caste, the king could not do the priest role, and the priest couldn't do the king role. In fact, in the Old Testament, one of the kings tried to burn incense, and the priests were telling him he can't do this, and he walked in the holy place and tried to do it anyway. And guess what? God made him leprous on the spot. to reinforce the fact that these two roles were supposed to remain separated. Now, no gods beyond me, and me being the I am, no gods beyond God. If you look at most of the list, this is considered the first precept. However, I folded this in with the second precept because I think it has more validity here. You have to state that God exists. Otherwise, none of this makes any sense. And you have to understand what it means to say that God exists. That nothing would exist here without God. Nothing. You see, you have to have that concept firmly in place. And what all that means? That means your understanding of right and wrong all comes from God. That's why you're made in His image. You have His understanding of right and wrong. And we're going to see how that changed here in a moment. So this is, I admit, a minority pattern. And the graphic of the two tablets that we had last week and again this week, and we'll have every week, as I highlight the particular precept we're discussing, follows this line of thought. Now, the idea of gods and idols are two sides of the same coin. If you're not going to have any other gods beyond God, then you're not going to have any representations either of those gods and goddesses. Gods being a generic term for both. So as man seeks a representation to unify the people about religion, government, the two are inseparable always. Now this is a foreign concept to the Western mindset today. In fact, almost to the whole world. Is that government and religion are inseparable. Let me repeat that. Government and religion cannot be separated. Now you can state that, and we do here in America. We kind of misstate our Constitution to suit our present day thoughts and philosophies. And the Constitution says the government will not establish a particular church, a particular religion. In other words, you're not going to have a, obviously, state church like they had in England. But to state that there is an impassable barrier between church and state is impossible. Because the state legislates morality. Morality is your right and wrong. What informs your morality is your religion. So the state, while it may say there is no religion and there can be no religion, what it's actually saying is that there's no religion but the one I want. That's going to support my understanding of right and wrong. That then becomes your idol. And as Americans, we really need to ponder this and understand the ramifications of it. Because it's not that the government is trying to stamp out church. It's that the government is trying to stamp out gospel. And the two are not the same. Now, Kell and Deleuze, and I know I'm mispronouncing them, are 19th century scholars in the Old Testament, it kind of wrote the foundational commentary on the Old Testament. And I really enjoyed going back and looking at that. So this commentary states that God is actually saying, you shall have no gods beyond me, which conveys better the meaning than before me. Now, all the translations you're going to read are going to have the second precepts coming out of God's mouth is saying, you shall have no other gods before me. In other words, there's a smorgasbord table of gods and goddesses, and you're going to pick which one you're going to follow. That's the idea that's conveyed in that statement, you'll have no gods before me. In other words, pick me, pick me, pick me. That's not what's happening. What God is actually saying, you shall have no gods beyond me, or there are no gods beyond me. It folds right back into the first precept in that I am God. There are no other gods. So there are no other gods beyond me. In other words, you have a table and it has one God on it, and that's it. That's your choice. God. So God established only the, or God established that he is the only God. That's the first precept. He only is God. Now he states there are no other gods. Any gods one makes are replacements for God, that is, beyond God. I don't like God. Therefore, I'm going to make up gods. And that is exactly what happens. Because God is irreplaceable. The infinite God cannot be replaced. Because by definition, anything that God creates, is finite. See, God's limited. He can't create something as great as himself. I mean, God can't do everything? Nope. He can't. Well, I thought God could do anything. False argument. No, he can't. God cannot sin. God cannot lie. God cannot violate his own will. I mean, his own nature. So God's will is limited. So God's sovereignty extends to God. Now, there's a concept that's not taught often. That God is sovereign not just over everything, but God himself is subject to his sovereignty. He can't violate it. So God is not outside of himself. Therefore, no, God cannot do anything. And God cannot do everything. So ancient man did not worship the idols as gods. In other words, they did not see the statue and say, "This statue is my God." Not at this point in time. Later on, as man becomes dumber or more ignorant or more primitive, as we would say, yes, they may do that. But by and large, in this period, they're not saying that. What they're saying is this statue or this painting or this fresco represents my God. God as I understand him. And so these forms, these representations, represents the various attributes of the gods they created beyond God. Now, in Hindu, even today, you go and look, they'll have 3 million idols, 4 million idols, the number just varies. But those are not separate gods. Those all represent the various attributes of Vishnu. The one God that has no form. So they give him a form so you can focus their worship on. What was the point of the temple that God is going to give them? To come and focus your attention upon what? Not worship. Upon Christ. Because what was the main function of the temple? Sacrifices. And what was the point of the sacrifices? Various pictures of the ultimate sacrifice of Christ. So that was the whole point of the temple, to focus your mind upon the sacrifice that is required for sin, and that you could not do that. And so everyone has these concrete representations that they use. As Christians, that cross that you plaster all over your church, that's a concrete representation of Christ. You use that. So we're really not far separated, are we? So they exchanged the truth of God for Satan, substituting the images representing the attributes they believed Satan had. Now, here's the point. And 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 6 and 7 tells us that everything that they sacrifice to these idols are actually being sacrificed to Satan. When you say demons, you're saying Satan. Because Satan, every time you read Satan in the scriptures, you might as well think Satan and demons, or the fallen angels. We'll just call them demons for short. So in verse 20, it says, I imply that what the pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy or zealousness? Are we stronger than he? And he's trying to drive this message home. Now in verses 6 to 7, it says, now these things took place as examples for us that we may not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters. As some of them were, as is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And that's not hopscotch. So they took the truth of God and they placed their understanding of God on Satan. And as we go along this study, we're going to see how that happened. But the only thing they know about Satan is what Satan tells them. Because, once again, he's in the spirit. And we have no mechanism to look into the spirit realm to know the difference between truth and lie. We are very much handicapped in that respect. And so here's an interesting pattern. It's an ancient pattern, but it's also a modern pattern. Man defines God, thus man believes he is God. However, sinful man is slave to Satan. Here in Romans 6, it tells us you're either a slave to God or you're a slave to Satan. What's the bottom line? You're a slave. The only thing God does is free you from being a slave to Satan and sin, so that you now are a slave to God. Therefore, worship of anything beyond God worships Satan. And of course, that's death. And so all false religions, and religion is being defined as a system of works, and the gospel is not a system of works. It is a system of faith that first comes from God that we reflect back to God. So, all religion denigrates God, lowers God to elevate man. If it's open theism, that's what it's doing. It says God has limited his sovereignty so that man may be free to choose. Denigrate God, elevate man. Anytime that is happening, warning bells should be going off in your head that this is a false religion. This is a wrong belief, and you should reject it. Because God never limits himself to elevate man. Satan will worship as common to everyone. Man's fall hinged on man being God. Remember Satan in the garden, Genesis chapter 3, comes to Eve, says, can't you eat everything? She said, no, we can't touch this thing. Because God's holding back on you. Because he knows you eat that, you'll be his gods. He lied. He left the impression that you eat of this, you'll be co-equal with God. And there are some religions that teach that today, and they're wrong. Christians are never equal with God. We're adopted sons of God, but we're not equal with God because we're never infinite. So the temptation of Christ, So man's nature mirrored his new creator, Satan. Once Adam ate of the fruit, knowingly rejecting God and seeing what would happen because he saw it mirrored in the woman already. The woman was tricked. She had nothing to go by. God did not tell her not to eat of the tree. Adam did. Adam added to God's word by telling her not to touch the tree. He's being careful. But every time you add to God's word, you get in trouble. Because now Satan was adding to God's word. And so now, as he just got pulled in there. But she had not seen the difference between a person who was not sinned and a person who had sinned. Adam did. He knew Eve before she sinned. Now he saw her after she sinned. And guess what? He liked what he saw. So, okay, I can, I'm for this one. And he ate. Now Satan became his new creator. Because now he's walking in the image of Satan. He cannot get rid of the image of God. That's where our morality is fixed. But now we have twisted that and tried to lay over that the values of Satan, which are an antithesis or actually working against the values of God. So Satan is now our new creator. And all people are born in the image of Satan. That's why you have that sin nature. And enslaves you to sin, because that's all you can do. You cannot not sin. From the moment you're conceived, according to Psalms 51, you are conceived in sin. You cannot not sin. That little baby everyone goos and caws over, that's an ugly, filthy, dirty, wretched sinner. Stop oohing and cawing on it. Look at it and say, how can I train this thing so that it just doesn't rise up in a few months and kill me? Because a baby is unrestrained evil. You spend most of the time the child is at home teaching it restraint, so it doesn't slaughter you in your sleep. Like Billy the Kid. He went on his killing spree as a young teen. His parents failed. He's not the first in history. But the temptation of Christ tried to do the same thing. Satan, the whole temptation of Christ hinged on the God-man Jesus worshiping Satan in exchange for sin, like Adam. Matthew chapter 4, fall down and worship me, and I will give you all of these kingdoms. They'll all be yours. Now that was a lie, kinda, because right now, here's Satan. Here's all the world kingdoms under him because he owns all of them. That includes America today. Now, if Christ worships Satan, he'll have all the kingdoms, right? But now he'll be under Satan and answerable to Satan. He'll actually be a slave to Satan like we are. No salvation for us. But actually, the ramifications are much more fundamental than that. Because not only does it destroy the hope of salvation for everyone, but God, when he violates his nature, cannot be God. So God is destroying himself. Literally. And if God is destroying himself, guess what? Everything that God created is destroyed. Now, here's the fundamental problem with finite creatures. We don't think through the ramifications of all our decisions. That's why we have these unintentional consequences that spring up and we're going, where did that come from? Where'd that come from? That came from the fact that you did not include every single factor in making your decision and the ramifications of that decision, and we can't because we're finite. So if Satan had gotten Christ to sin, and Christ sinned, not only would God flash out of existence and all creation flash out of existence, who created Satan? God. So if everything that God created is gone, guess who else is gone? Satan. He'd be gone too. Everything. Nothing. In an instant. Gone. So it's not just Christ sinning, but entire creation is sitting here, breath, bated breath, waiting for Christ to see whether he's going to sin or not, whether creation is going to continue or gone. All of it. I'd rather look. Now, in this one, God gave this precept to warn man of spiritual and physical degradation that affects all aspects of life. Idolatry degrades man. We go to Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, and we follow this downward progression as man recognized the truth of God and rejected the truth of God and turned to idolatry. What did man do? Man started living a degraded life. If you degrade yourself spiritually, it's going to degrade yourself physically, morally. Because what you do comes from what you believe. The two are linked. You cannot believe one thing and act another. That's called acting, that being a hypocrite. Now, we all try to do that. But in actuality, you're going to live out what you believe. That informs your morality. That informs your values. That informs your whole sense of right and wrong and your behaviors that spring from that. And guess what? Man embraces the degradation. Why do you think our government and the people that support that are passing these laws, legitimizing homosexuality and lesbianism and transgenderism and calling wrong right and right wrong? So they can legitimize this degradation. You have to legitimize yourself. Raise yourself up. That's even spoken of in those last couple of verses there in that section of Romans chapter 1. That these sinners come together, finding other sinners like themselves to support themselves. Because they know they're deserving of death. That's always in the back of their mind. But if we pass along, we all band together, that won't happen. Yeah, it does. So idolatry legitimizes Satan's case against man. Remember, Satan's the accuser. He's the district attorney. What's he trying to do? Prove that man is unworthy of salvation. Thus, everything that God created is evil. Therefore, God is evil. Now, James chapter 1 tells us that God is not the author of sin. But Satan's case is God is the author of sin. And if God can prove through us that everybody sins, well, that's not hard to prove, then God must then not punish anyone, which means God will not punish Satan. So you see, Satan's making this case to save his butt because he's already condemned. He knows this. So all about end times and all of this, that's what it's about. Universalism. Satan saving his butt. He's not going to be king in hell. People that are in hell are not going to be serving him. That's a medieval concept. That's foolishness. So idolatry drives man into gross spiritual and physical immorality. It has to, because its basis is sin. Jealous or zealous God. You know, the English word jealous is such a negative word. So somebody who's just angry and out of control, and they're going to fix the problem at everybody else's expense. But that's not what's there in the Hebrew or the Greek words. It's zealous. In other words, they are committed. You want zealous people on your team. You want people that are committed on your team to the goals of what your team is doing, whether it's in healthcare or medicine or education or whatever. You want committed people. That's why you have mission, vision, goals, and all this other mess. So you want people to be committed to these things. We want zealous people. And God is zealous for our good based on his holiness. Now, it has to be based on his holiness because God cannot reject his holiness. In other words, God has not sinned. Man has sinned. God has to figure out a way to bridge that chasm between his holiness and man's unholiness. And of course, that would be Jesus Christ and the cross. Christ became unholy on the staros, on the stake for us, taking our place there. Psalm 22. And then being resurrected because his sacrifice was acceptable. God's firstborn, his sacrifice, his Passover, that's why he was crucified on the Passover, was acceptable. Whereas the Egyptians' firstborn on the first Passover, their sacrifice was not acceptable because none of them were resurrected because they all had sin. And the ones who lived through the Passover did not sacrifice. They cowered respectfully under the sacrifice of the innocent victim, representing Christ's coming sacrifice, Romans chapter 3. So instead, this negates the idea of a jealous God hurting man for false worship. In other words, you're not doing what I told you, you're ticking me off, so I got to kill you. That's not what God is. People paint him as that in the Old Testament and then negate him or reject him. But that's not what he's doing. Because remember, the God of the Old Testament is the Christ of the New Testament. They're the same. Instead, God, Jesus Christ, warns man of consequences of sins in ways that man can understand. Now, during the Axial Age, in the Hebrews, both Israel and then Israel and Judah, God sent them prophets. All during that Axial Age, calling them back, calling out the true Jews like Elijah and the 7,000 of his time period. Calamities. God is the author of calamities. I believe it's in Isaiah. It calls it evil. But if you look, it's translated as evil, but when you look at the Hebrew, it says he's the author of calamities. Earthquakes, floods. Not all of them. We see that Satan does too, if you read the first two chapters of Job. But it's to warn man, to bring man back. And degradation in your life. God gives you up to your sin. God's not beating you up because of it. He's giving you up to it so that you can swallow in it and realize what it's, but I don't realize that I love it. I want to legalize it. And in fact, I want everybody to do it. So it'd be the same for everybody. And then God won't be able to punish anybody. So God warns of consequences. The degradation of sin not only affects the people who do it, that's all of us, but also legitimizes the sin to the youth. So the degradation becomes normal. Psalms and Proverbs, especially Proverbs, has a lot to say about teaching wrong for right and right is wrong. And it's exactly what we're doing today and have been doing in our public education system, knowingly so, from the very beginning. The DVD Indoctrination shows the history of that much better than any other medium I've seen. And we see this trend in our own lifetimes in pop music, movies, even casual sex. Not only is it becoming more casual and more open, but it's happening at younger and younger and younger ages. So now it's happening in the preteen area. We see the music from the 40s and 50s where they don't mention about sex, where they talk about love and I need you and all this, to where in the 80s and 90s and even today, it's a lot more degrading. It's a lot more openly spoken of. The language is a lot worse. And even in the movies. So in Hollywood in the 30s and the 40s, this reversal of roles between men and women starting, and now today it's just taken for granted. And the people who go there see it as normal, and they demand it out of their legislatures, and then they have to live with the consequences of it, which then they don't like, so now they get to share bathrooms. This pattern can last three or four generations, but indeed, if the leaders try to legitimize the sin in their nation, it can last for centuries. And we can look at ancient cultures that lasted 1,000 years, like Assyria, like Egypt. Because it then becomes a cultural practice, and you can't let it go because it means it's you. That's why the Arabs have embraced Islam. It's now their culture, and they cannot let it go because they feel they won't be them. Same way with the Jews in false Judaism. Same way with the Western nations in false Christendom. That's me. I can't let go. Because it shows that I am. But what it does show is that you are locked into that sin. You have legitimized that practice. And now you have hardened it so that you are identified by sin. It's a form of idolatry. And adultery is prevalent today. It's practiced today in many forms, legitimizing the degradation and promoting the sin as philosophies and religions. Atheistic governments, such as communism, and what America is turning into. Man is the idol. In democracies, that'd be Western countries, America included. How does our Constitution start? We the people. Man is the idol. When we stand up there as Christians and say we defend the Constitution, we are defending idolatry over Scripture. That's what you're doing. Now I'm hearing a million yes buts. But I don't have to hear him today. Christendom. That's all the religions that claim the Bible but don't actually preach the gospel, the true gospel of Christ. Man is the idol. Judaism, since Christ, with their Talmud and the Kabbalah, or Kabbalah. Man is the idol. Islam. Man is the idol. Paganism. Man is the idol. Hinduism, man is the idol. You name it, man is the idol. Gospel, what's the first step of salvation? Repentance, man is not the idol. That's the first thing you have to acknowledge. I am a sinner. Thus, you're not going to stand up here and say, man is the idol, because now you're having to say, I am the sinner. None of these will do that. And today, there is the move toward globalization. Now, in the 20th century, we saw this move toward regionalization. And we saw it move that way because of wars. Wars are a great motivator in society. Most of the devices and inventions that everyone loves today, even the healthcare system we have today, grew out of wars. Modern medicine, as you understand it, grew out of the French Revolution. Grew out of World War I, World War II, Vietnam. Wars are a great motivator in society. But in World War I, we saw this regionalization start to occur. We saw the germinal aspects of it in the early 19th century. Because when Wellington defeated Napoleon, Wellington had a coalition, first step toward regionalization. In fact, the 19th century was full of treaties and counter-treaties and this group of nations against this group of nations. And that led into World War I. And out of that, we had this first step toward globalization. And who was the harbinger of that? That would be America. Bring globalization to the world based upon their great, great, great leader they love and adore, Abraham Lincoln. And the aftermath of strong federalism over sovereign states after the Civil War. We brought this to the world. Now, I didn't catch the first time, so we had to have another war with other alliances, and then it caught. And then it was called the United Nations. And it's supported by these various pseudosciences, such as, you know, public education is teaching globalization. If you go back and look at, go back to indoctrination and see how this progressed. So that we were all steeped in this, but especially in the last 40 years or so. And psychology supports it. Psychology is not a science, it's a philosophy. It's a philosophy that says, I know what your mind is. But your mind is outside the bounds of science. It cannot be touched. I mean, the brain can, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the mind. Mind is like the spirit. In fact, in the Bible, it is a spirit. Therefore, it's outside the realms of science, which are limited by the empirical, your five senses. Yet psychology can put you away without a trial, without a charge, without your consent, in a heartbeat. Globalization legalizes the idolatry in laws and regulations or bureaucracy. In fact, the UN has what's called the Human Rights of Man. You should read that. It's very interesting. It's on board by several of the science fiction writers of the early era, because they were all globalization humanists. So if you love science fiction, you were being programmed. It was a sad day when I realized that. Globalization legitimizes degradation. So the human rights are interpreted to mean, human rights, UN Human Rights of Man, are interpreted to mean all forms of physical immorality are legitimized. Because you can't call someone wrong. In fact, in Germany, they have special zoos for people who like animals. All religions are legitimized, except the gospel, of course, because it's considered divisive. All practices promoting unity of man, that'd be idolatry, are allowed. All dissent are labeled as hate crimes and thus become illegal. That would be the gospel. General welfare of all men is used to suppress salvation. Now, guess where they got that from? They got that from the Constitution, from Hamilton, when he slipped in the general welfare clause. And many, many laws that you don't like today are passed to promote the general welfare. What does it mean? Don't know. No one ever bothered defining it. Thus, it can mean anything you want it to mean. So idolatry brings unity of sin. Worship of man as God is used to promote unity through idolatry, which God disrupted at the Ziggurat of Babel, which dispersed man, preventing gospel suppression. Remember, the whole point of the Ziggurat of Babel was to suppress knowledge of God. Promoting man, you have to denigrate God. And God confused their languages so they could not do that. And man, sinful man, is naturally hateful of others. Since they're not the same anymore, they started repelling each other. Today, man is trying to reverse that. Globalization seeks to reunite man with Gnosticism as a substrate to bind all the religions into one, which will suppress the true salvation as divisive. Thus, we have World Religion Day. Religion must be the cause of unity. You thought it was going to be climate change and global warming and eco foundations and all of this stuff, militant ecology. Well, they all have their place. But the basis of right and wrong is religion. All these other things will follow along. And they even say, this little graphic over here, we are all Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, atheists, Christians, Jews. When you line that up, it says humans. So act like it. But what is implied there is we are all sinful humans. And we do act like it. So we can all agree on our sin. And that will unify us. We don't unify around the fact that we can repent and come to God. Because God says, whomsoever may come. But that's not what man wants. So the false prophet is at work. Divisive religions are hate. So Christendom up here, teacher goes along and cuts their little thoughts and makes them into crosses, and they all become little Christians, hate-filled. Same way with the rabbi here for these kids. Turn them into Jews, Judaism. Same way for the Muslim with the little kids, turning them into Muslims. So you have, it says divisive religions, individual religions are hate. Now notice which ones they didn't put in that. They didn't put Confucius, they didn't put Hinduism, they didn't put Buddhism. They put any of the pantheistic faiths in there, did they? Not a one. But they do the same thing. But here, a unified religion is love. See, that's the danger of open theism in Christendom, is that it's moved into this realm. And we see here all the symbols of these various faiths around the central symbol, which is the light. Move toward the light. You know, that's what Gnosticism is. Light. That's how it advertises itself. But we know it's a false light that brings darkness. So here's the face of Gnosticism. The goal of idolatry is slavery to Satan. One God, one love, world oneness movement, globalization. All of these will come to be into one. That's the role of the false prophet, just so you know. But behind that, what is actually happening is you're ensnared. You're snared in the circle of Satan's teaching. And within that is man and woman, the snakes and the sin, devouring each other. The degradation of sin. And the Messiah is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And when they ate of that, guess what they discovered? They were the evil. So the alternative to idolatry is God's love. Now God demonstrates his love for thousands of generations. And the fact that we love God, not because we love God, but because God first loved us. Because we can't love God as lost sinners. Because we hate God. We're at war with God. Because we hate God. Because we'd have to say we're sinners and a sinner can't say that. So we keep his precepts as we are now new creations in him. Based on his work of the cross, he becoming sin for us. Thus, the second precept teaches faith. Hebrews could not love God or follow his precepts, for they, like us, or sin and hate God. Now I say sin and not sinners, because when we say the word sinners, we think of actions. I'm a sinner because I lied, or I cheated, or I did this, or I did that. No, the acts only inform you that you are indeed a sin. You are sin. You're a born sin. You're not good and just messed up. You're evil. And you practice it constantly. Every thought is captive to sin. Every action is captive to sin. Every deed is captive to sin. And it's only as parents that we try to teach you how to control that. That is why one of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. That's a hallmark between a lost and a saved per person, is that self-control. You cannot control yourself. Christ controls you. Romans 8. It is only by faith from God that one can believe that God exists. That's the first precept. And believes that he gives life and frees from idolatry, which is what meditating on the second precept tells you. In fact, we want to go to 1 John. And that's chapter 5, verses 18 through the end of the chapter. And it says, we know that everyone who has been born of God does not keep on sinning. In other words, you're not in sin, then everything comes from sin. But he who was born of God, the new creation, protects him, and the evil one does not touch you. In other words, God protects you, and the evil one does not pull you back into a sin nature. He cannot. We know that we are from God, and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. We know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know him who is true, and we are in him who is true. And in his Son, Jesus Christ, he is the true God and eternal. Little children, keep yourself from idols. Because John knew this. John sat under Christ's teaching for 3.5 years. And then for another 40 years, 50 years, he meditated on all of this. And this is the conclusion he comes to. That's how he closes out his first letter. Keep yourself from idols. Even you are the idol. Then through Christ, we shun the idolatry of Satan. Not through our efforts. Because you know, from our efforts, we don't recognize idolatry. We would be caught captive to it all the time. That's a warning of Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Avoid the changing winds of these myths that people will gather together because they have itchy ears. They want to hear these things, and they will reject the truth to follow these myths. And in the Greek, it says myths. Often it's translated as lies, but that's not what it's saying. It's saying the myths of idolatry. And we want to avoid these. We don't want to get trapped into a false religion. We don't want to get trapped in following a bunch of rules. We don't want to get trapped in doing things without thinking. But most of the time, we're not really ready to sit down and read the scriptures and see what they truly mean and all their ramifications. And thus, even the Christians become captive to our own sin.